I'm Kate 2, Romeo India Whiskey. At this time, we begin the sick net. Usual for most Sunday evenings, from 8 o'clock, local to midnight, local usually. Main purpose of the technical net is education. We gather the clan of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about radio. This is a real fun hobby that's extremely educational. The curious people are the ones who want to know how does this radio signal do so much action at a distance? How come when you put a signal into that antenna, that signal goes everywhere in the universe, literally? And if you got sensitive enough equipment, you can receive that signal almost anywhere. How in the world does that radio signal lead your antenna and do all of that? We try to answer some of those questions. There's no exact answer to it, obviously. The TechNet consists of people gathering to help each other because they've each learned a little bit of the puzzle as to how all this stuff works. Let me drop. As I said, it's an extremely educational hobby. By way of ham radio, I learned an awful lot about electronics, radio electronics, receivers, transmitters, antennas, transmission lines, and that became my occupation. There are quite a number of people who have listened to the technical net, decided that, gee, these people are having a lot of fun delving into this hobby, and they decided that they had discovered the TechNet or similar things on their scanner, and decided to go out and get a license and actually join the crowd, join the fun. The way a person signs into the TechNet is to give me your questions, your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. TechNet began in 1982. That was, 34 or so years ago, 35 years ago. By now, we believe somebody's listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. Tonight, let me drop. This will be TechNet number 1,642 of the series that began in September of 1982. You'll also be hearing the Space Report, number 242, from Paul WS2N, who keeps us informed on what's the latest that NASA is doing, what launches are going to be made this week, and what their hardware out there is really doing. I keep asking him what Voyager is doing. That's that spacecraft launched in 1977. It's out there 3 times the distance to Pluto, 12 billion miles away. At the speed of light, the signal going to Voyager and coming back takes 37 hours. At the speed of light, that's really out there. That's the most long-range piece of electronics, piece of hardware of any kind that mankind has ever issued. It has literally left the solar system and is now measuring galactic wind instead of solar wind, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, those are pretty serious pieces of hardware, as is the Hubble Space Telescope and the soon-to-be-launched James Webb Space Telescope. Okay, if you guys got questions and comments, you're going to give me your call letters, your name, at this time. K2LI, if you're listening.
KD2HUC, Steve, yes.
W2YY, Joe, yes.
Okay, we've got Steve and Joe so far. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
And WS2N is here with the space report. Like you said before, Dick. Good evening, Dick. Back to you.
And space report number 242 is about to come up. So once again, we've got Steve and Joe. Anyone else with a question or a comment to join the TechNet? Even and by the way, don't worry about your question being too simple or too complicated. The main philosophy of the people on the TechNet is that there's no such thing as a dumb question. The so-called dumb question is the one that represents the biggest difference between what the guy knows and what he would like to know. Therefore, his His question is most deserving of an answer. So don't worry about the fact you think you've got a dumb question. One more call. Anyone wants to sign in with a question or a comment, please give me a call letters and name right now. Okay, maybe we'll have some more people check in a little bit later. Steve, you're number one on the runway. And how have those electrons been treating you this week? KD2HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hi, KD2HUC. I think the electrons have been behaving, which is pretty much all we can ask for. My question tonight is regarding a picture of a 160 megahertz antenna that I sent you via email. Did you get it?
Once again, the antenna you mailed me a picture of, I think you said 160 meters. Run that by again.
No, it's 160 megahertz. It's above, it's shorter than 2 meters.
Okay. Bear in mind that I'm quite forgetful. The 160 megahertz antenna you mailed me, was it a day ago, a week ago, a month ago? Give me a hint, Steve, go ahead.
It was within the past week or so.
Okay. Describe the antenna, maybe it'll come back to me, and go right ahead with your question.
The antenna is designed for use on, well, at least as far as I know, rail-bound equipment, trains, locomotives, and such. It looks like a solid piece of metal. I haven't been able to get my hands on one yet just to throw my eyes on it and see, you know, how this thing could possibly work. But just looking at it in the picture, it looks like one solid chunk of metal. It's very confusing to me how this antenna could work. I don't think there could be any type of element inside it, because I would assume that the chunk of metal, so to speak, would shield the signal. Let me let it drop.
Yeah, now I remember the picture. Stand by. Yes, that is, let me think. There's a name for the kind of antenna. At one time, there was a ham radio article where they called it a longhorn antenna. The antenna he's describing, although it looks like a solid chunk of metal, which is a function of the weight, but it looks like it's mounted on a flat piece of metal. It comes off the piece of metal at right angles for an inch or two or three. It then bends over at a 90-degree angle, and the majority of the antenna lays parallel to the ground plane. So it comes up a couple of inches and lays over sideways, parallel to the ground plane, probably a foot or so. If you took a quarter wave ground plane antenna, the radiator, and simply bent it over near the base, bent it so that it's parallel to the top of the sheet metal in your car, so to speak, that is the antenna itself. Let me drop it. And good common sense would lead you to believe, Steve, that since the majority of the metal of the radiator is parallel to the ground plane, you would think it's being shielded from radiation. Good guess, absolutely not. And by the way, that is a simplified version of a patch antenna. You can take a sheet of insulating material, lay it on top of a great big sheet of metal, then put another sheet of metal on top of it, which is either a half wavelength in length, a half wavelength in width, or maybe a half wavelength in width and length. You could put a square of metal on top of a insulator, which is, let's say, a quarter of an inch thick. That in turn is laying on top of a ground plane. It looks like there's nothing out in space to radiate, so to speak. And you launch a signal into that upper piece of metal. That patch antenna radiates extremely well. It's a little bit high in Q. How thick is the insulator determines what the Q is. In the case of your antenna, your longhorn, I'm going to call it, antenna, the bent over section that's laying parallel to the ground plane how much space it has to the ground plane determines its Q. As you make that space smaller and smaller, the antenna has more and more narrowband characteristics. But at its resonant frequency, it will radiate like a charm. Let me drop. And the way you feed that antenna, you can either feed the bottom of the radiator, so to speak, the part that goes into the sheet metal, or you can put a probe an inch or two down range from the end that goes down to the ground plane. You put a probe across that into a connector where the signal is being fed from behind the ground plane, and so it's a little bit like a I'm having trouble remembering the inverted L. Yes, inverted L. I think they call it an inverted L antenna. It's a popular antenna that's used quite often inside a cell phone. That antenna you're seeing, Steve, believe it or not, a version of that is inside of a number of cell phones. So even though it looks like there's no real radiator out in the space, let me drop it. As long as that upper piece of metal, with that short piece going down to the ground plane, where it's sometimes fed, and then the majority of it lays parallel to the ground plane, as long as that is a resonant length, and you can force it into resonance by an antenna tuner, even if it doesn't start off as a resonant length, as long as that system is part of a radiator, that signal bounces back and forth, and that upper piece of radiator metal, and eventually all of that signal gets radiated. That signal, although that antenna can be somewhat narrowband, it cannot be 100% efficient. Your next question is going to be, what kind of radiation pattern is it going to have? The radiation pattern is very, very similar to a quarter wave ground plane radiation, although it's got a little bit, it does favor one particular direction. It favors the direction where the upper piece of metal points, so to speak. It favors that direction. It sort of, it favors end fire a little bit. But as bad a radiator as that looks, of the 5,000 kinds of antennas, patch antennas are the worst example I know of, where they look like they shouldn't radiate at all. And I've worked on a number of patch antennas, and at their resonant frequency, they work like a charm. So is this some of the answer you're looking for? I know this is a mysterious-looking antenna. It looks like it shouldn't work. Believe me, it works like a charm. I might be able to find the chapter in the Antenna Engineering Handbook that shows you some examples of this particular antenna. KD2-HUC, K2-RIW. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, but I got it. So what you're saying is that this antenna, because when I'm looking at it, it looks like one solid piece of metal. So I'm assuming that when it's mounted on whatever it's mounted on, it has to be mounted to an insulator. Is that a true statement?
It may look like a solid piece of metal. What you're seeing is the paint on top of the radome. There's a real piece of, the long length in there is a chunk of metal above the ground plane. The whole thing gets mounted directly on a sheet of metal, Steve. You don't put an insulator under it. I know I described that as part of a patch antenna. In this particular case, that antenna gets screwed down to the top of a railroad car, or to the side of the fuselage of an airplane, or to the roof of an automobile. So it looks like a solid sheet of metal. I guarantee if you had a way of dissecting it, you're going to find out that there is a upper piece of metal on the longest dimension that curves over at a right angle and goes into the ground plane. It really is a quarter wave ground plane antenna, where an inch or two from the bottom, you bent the radiator at a 90 degree angle, and the majority of the radiator lies parallel to the sheet metal of, say, the automobile. As I said, it's called an inverted L. It's also called a longhorn. It's got a number of names like that, but that radiates very well. Over to you, Steve, K2-RIW.
Okay, yeah, that answers my question. So this antenna would work on just about anything. It doesn't have to be on rail-bound equipment, because I was kind of curious if maybe this antenna was designed with the, you know, with the rails in mind as a counterpoise. But from what you're describing, I could bolt this thing to just about anything and it would work, as long as it's metallic. Is that a true statement?
Steve, and now you get the concept. So, there's a hell of a lot of antennas where the majority of the radiator section is parallel to a sheet of metal, a ground plane, and it looks like it shouldn't radiate. And I said the most extreme example is a so-called patch antenna. If you simply Google the word patch, P-A-T-C-H, antenna, you'll see some pictures of antennas that are wrapped around the side of a missile, so to speak, and they stick up above the surface of the missile by a quarter of an inch. Look like they shouldn't radiate at all. They radiate like a charm. So any piece of metal that is a resonant length in one of its dimensions, and you feed a radio signal into it, it'll radiate. You resonate first, then it can radiate. Those seven words are the most important words in your language if you're going to be an antenna designer. You resonate first, then it can radiate. So any piece of metal, not in complete contact with the ground plane, that's a resonant length, and you're feeding signal into it, at that frequency where it resonates, it'll radiate like a charm. And even though you may have put a loading capacitor at the end, or you've zigzagged it, or helically wound it, or put a loading inductor at the bottom, there's all kinds of ways you can take this antenna type and shrink it down in size, physical, but still yet be electronically resonant, and you would think that, you're going to get an extremely small effective capture area as a receiver. You're going to get very poor radiation efficiency as a transmitter. You'd make all of those guesses using good common sense. You'd be dead wrong in every one of those cases. Let me drop. So any piece of metal in almost any orientation, as long as that piece of metal can be made to resonate, and you feed signal into it with a reasonable impedance match between your transmission line and that radiator, it can radiate with 100% efficiency. The so-called infinitesimal dipole has the full area of a full half-wave dipole within half a dB. You only lose a few percent in what you think is the gain and radiation pattern. In reality, you didn't lose any real gain. The pattern just became a little bit broader because you made your dipole an infinitesimal length. As long as you've made it out of low insertion loss materials, good quality insulator, good quality conductor. Don't use carbon granules as the antenna, if you know what I mean. As long as you meet the requirement of low efficient, low loss materials and the resonant structure, it'll radiate. KD2HUC, K2RIW, go ahead, Steve.
I gotta say, that's very cool. Because, like you said, you look at this antenna and there's no way it should work. So, that's why I posed the question. I appreciate the time, Dick, and I'm going to try and get my hands on one of these just so I can, look at it and try and put two and two together. But, as always, I appreciate it. KD2HUC, back to net.
Some of the most extreme antennas. I gave you already an example of a patch antenna. Another one is a slot antenna. You can have a great big sheet of metal, and you drill a slot, you cut with a saw a slot in the metal, and you make the slot a half wavelength long in the long dimension, and maybe a quarter of an inch a width across the slot, that will radiate like a charm. That's called Babinet's rule. Let me explain what Babinet's rule is. One of the crazy rules of antennas. You and I know what a dipole looks like. It's a piece of wire. You can make your piece of wire a half wavelength long with no insulator in the center. Half wavelength long, and you decide to feed it at one end. You don't have to feed it in the center. As long as you've got a piece of wire, half wavelength long, and a method by which you can launch signal into it, you've got a beautiful half wave dipole. It's a conductor in free space. Now if you do the exact opposite, you start off with a great big sheet of conductor, and you make a slot in it, which is an insulator, a half wavelength long. You've done the exact same thing as building a half wave dipole, but what used to be insulator, you've made conductor. What used to be conductor is insulator. By Babinet's rule, you'll get the exact same gain, the exact same antenna pattern out of that reverse antenna. The only thing that changes is will be opposite in polarization. A half wavelength slot, horizontally polarized, so to speak, is a vertically polarized radiator. A half wavelength dipole, parallel to the Earth, is a horizontally polarized radiator. So, except for the reverse in polarization, you get the exact same gain, the exact same pattern, and in some cases, the exact same bandwidth. Ain't that crazy? So, you take any
repeater, time out.
So, let me reinforce that. You take any kind of antenna you know about, which is a conductor with some kind of a shape in free space, and you make the exact opposite. You start off with a great big sheet of metal, and you cut slots in it that are the shape of the metal of your previous antenna. You'll get the exact same performance. Polarization will be reversed, but the inverse antenna. So, because there are 5,000 kinds of antennas that we know about, some of them happen to be slot, but if there wasn't any slot antennas, and you suddenly discovered Babinet's rule, you could now make another complete set of antennas. You'd make 10,000 antennas instead of 5,000 by taking every one of the antennas you know of and making the reverse in a sheet of metal. And so, frequency selective surfaces fall into this category. I'll give you another example. You can cut a slot into the side of the fender of your car, or the fuselage of your airplane, or along the leading edge of the rudder of an airplane. You cut a slot in the metal, right along the leading edge of the wing of the airplane, and you feed signal into that slot. It's a beautiful radiator. You'll be amazed how many antennas are completely flush, no wind resistance at all, just covered over with some kind of a insulating material, a radome, and the slot in the sheet metal is a beautiful antenna. Over to you for any further questions or comments on all of this craziness of antennas, Steve. You brought up a good question. 82HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Wow, that's absolutely crazy. This is the first that I'm hearing of that. So, now let me ask you this, Dick. How does the size of the conductor affect the performance of the antenna? I mean, you know, it's when you have a half-wave dipole, you kind of have, you know, the fixed conductor and then pretty much infinite insulator around it, you know, being the air. When you do the reverse, you're not going to have infinite conductor. So what parameters would you use? I mean, is there a perfect size that goes with the slot for the conductor, or, you know, does it not matter? KD2HUC, back to net.
Now, those are two very good lead-on questions, follow-on questions for what you originally asked us, Steve. First of all, that dipole I put in free space. As I make the wire of the dipole larger and larger in diameter, my dipole becomes broader and broader in bandwidth. The 3-to-1, the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio bandwidth becomes broader and broader. When it comes up to UHF antenna, that dipole-like structure at, say, 900 megacycles, the best one you could build would not be out of a piece of wire, but you take a piece of copper foil, and you'd make the copper foil into a dipole-like length, but make the width, the dipole-like length at 900 megs might be 4.5 inches long. But the copper foil that you're using to make the dipole, you don't use a piece of a 16-gauge wire. You make it out of this foil, and you make the foil a half inch or three-quarters of an inch wide. You end up with a very broadband dipole. You know, you go the next step, and you make a three-element Yagi out of copper foil, where the driven element, the reflector, and the director are all made out of copper foil, a half inch wide, and roughly 4.5 inches long for the director, driven element, and reflector. Let me drop. You carry that out correctly, and you end up with a Yagi-like antenna or a dipole-like antenna, which is multiple times the bandwidth if you made it out of thin wire. So, in the case of 80 meters, you would love to make your dipole out of a chunk of wire that is 10 feet in diameter and 132 feet long. Well, that's not practical. By way of a cage structure, putting a whole bunch of wires side by side, so to speak, you can make a skeleton version of the 10-foot diameter dipole on 80 meters. And people have done that. And you do get a hell of a lot more bandwidth when you do it. So, diameter of the wire, the diameter of the radiator, gives you bandwidth. As long as you've made it out of low loss materials, you don't end up with more efficiency. You don't end up with more gain. You just end up with more bandwidth. On top of that, your dipole works very well if you've not mounted it 60 feet in the air, but you mount it 10 feet in the air. In other words, your dipole under ideal conditions is a conductor in space, and the insulator of space goes on to infinity in all directions. Let me drop. You can mount your 80-meter dipole 20 feet above the ground instead of 60 feet above the ground. It doesn't have infinite space all around it. It's got infinite space straight up, but straight down, it's looking into the Earth. That dipole still works very well. The Earth is going to give you some reflection. It's going to give you a lot of increase in the angle of your signal going out to the horizon. It's going to have an elevation pattern to it. But the dipole still works with near 100% efficiency if you mount it rather close to a major conductor. By the same token, now when you're making a slot antenna, the sheet metal of your slot antenna doesn't have to go on to infinity. If the sheet metal goes one or two wavelengths in two directions, that's good enough. And you've got a slot down the middle of that sheet of metal, and the width of a slot tells you bandwidth, just like the diameter of the wire of a dipole tells you bandwidth. The slot length tells you the resonant frequency. And by the way, you feed that slot antenna by putting a piece of wire across the slot and feeding a signal into that piece of wire. So near the short circuit end of the slot, you mount your connector, and your connector, one end of the connector touches the sheet metal on the near side of the slot. The center conductor bridges the gap and goes over to the far side of the slot. That's how you're launching a signal across the slot near the short circuit end of your slot in that sheet of metal. So launching a signal into the sheet of metal, into the slot, is not very difficult. And the sheet of metal doesn't have to go on to infinity, just like the air around your dipole doesn't go on to infinity, particularly in the direction down to the ground plane. There's a one-to-one relationship here. Ain't that something else to learn, Steve? Opposite of common sense? KD2HUC, K2IW, check that. Glad you're asking these questions.
Repeater, time out.
Hey, did UPS? UPS recognized, but Steve first. Go ahead, Steve. Wait for the beeps.
So, Dick, just so I have my head wrapped around this. If I took a 6-inch by 6-inch square sheet of metal, and in the center, I soldered the center conductor from a wire, and then maybe a half inch away from it, further down, I soldered the shield, and I keyed my radio into it, it's a dead short. I cut a slot up to where that connection is, that's on a resonant length on the frequency that I'm transmitting, and I'm just throwing out numbers like 6x6, but I just cut a slot in it, and now all of a sudden, it's not a short, and it's a radiator. Do I have that right?
You have that right. You put your... Let's start off with a 1 foot square sheet of metal. And let's assume now I'm going to make a dipole for the 900 megacycle region, 915 megs. And a slot is going to be in the vicinity of 4.5 inches long. So somewhere in the middle of this 1 foot square of metal, I've made a slot 4.5 inches long, and the slot is an eighth of an inch wide. And it's 4.5 inches long, and approximately 1 inch from one end of that slot, I put a piece of wire that bridges the gap across the slot. That wire bridging the gap is the center conductor of my connector, input connector, and the shield of the input connector is on the near side of the slot. The center conductor bridges the gap and goes over to the far side. You put your ohmmeter on that connector, center conductor to shield, and you measure 0 ohms. You'll say, that thing's a dead short circuit. That can't possibly radiate. You put a signal into that connector, at 915 megacycles, you will measure a 50-ohm resistor resonant at 915 megs. You'll be radiating a signal from that slot equal to the signal you would radiate from a piece of wire dipole 4.5 inches long fed in the center. So your ohm meter tells you it can't possibly be an antenna. But the slot is a resonant structure. The signal, the E-field is across that slot. The E-field is strongest in the center of the slot. Of course, it's zero at the short circuit end. And so that's a Babnitz rule, inverse dipole antenna. Let me drop. It has all of the gain, bandwidth, beamwidth. It is a dipole antenna where what used to be conductor and what used to be free space, you've now made the free space a conductor. You've made what used to be the conductor a piece of free space, the slot. It's an exact inverse antenna. It'll have all the same characteristics. Opposite of common sense. The first time you build a slot antenna, as I did, I said to myself, this can't possibly work. But there's the picture in the antenna engineering handbook. There's all the equations as to how it works. There's all the examples of people who have built it. I made the leap of faith. I built it and tried it, connected it to a vector network analyzer, and it works like a charm. And it took me a while to believe that. Let's see what Rich has got to say. K2UPS, out of curiosity, Rich, where are you tonight? And go ahead with your... Tell us first where you are, and then what the weather's like out there, because I know there's one hell of a storm heading for us. And then your question. K2UPS, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Thank you, Dan. K3UPS Mobile. Well, it's 34 degrees and not too bad out tonight. Just outside of Columbus, Ohio, heading back to New York. 2 hours delayed due to an electrical wiring problem in one of the trailers. So we're behind schedule. But when you were talking about the patch antenna before, and that antenna on the railroad, I believe they use that particular design because it's pretty durable under the working environment that they're in, and they can't really have something sticking up due to tight clearances, both in yards, tunnels, and that sort of stuff. So I think that's why they go with that design. But is that the same type of thing that they're using now on most the police cars? If you look at the rear trunk, sometimes it's on the roof, but usually it's on the trunk lid. You see, it looks like a black hockey puck, maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5, maybe 6 inches in diameter, and 3/4 of an inch, maybe an inch thick. And that's what they're using. It's pretty much on UHF frequencies. But would that be a type of patch antenna? Back to you.
Yeah, very likely it is. The nice thing about this inverted L antenna and the patch antenna, the so-called longhorn antenna, is that it's a very low profile, very sturdy. You're not going to have to worry about hitting a tree limb or hitting the garage door. If you know what I mean, the roll-up garage door as you park your car in the garage. And so that circular thing profile to the trunk of a car, a police car, quite possibly is a patch antenna. So that even though the radiator doesn't stick up like a quarter-wave monopole, I mean, all of our traditional thinking about ham radio antennas is the radiator has to be as far away from the ground plane as possible. That's our thinking. Not necessarily true. In the case of a patch antenna, the sheet of metal is parallel to the ground plane, a very small distance between it and the ground plane, with some insulating material in there, a sheet of plastic of some kind in many cases. And as long as the sheet of metal, that's the radiator, parallel to the ground plane, is a resonant length in one of its dimensions, as long as it's a resonant length in at least one dimension, it'll radiate like a charm. And it doesn't even have to be physically resonant. In other words, it can be a little bit too short to be resonant, which means it's going to be a capacitive antenna, and you've got a antenna tuning network connected to the resonant. Slot not a full half wavelength long. I've had an example where one of the antennas I had designed for one of my clients, let me drop. So wasn't enough room in the sheet metal to make the slot a full half wavelength long. I probably made it about 75% of the right length. but in the middle of the slot, halfway between the two short circuit ends, I bridged a capacitor across the slot. That added the extra capacitance that got rid of the inductance I had because the slot was too short. It brought it into resonance, and it radiated like a charm. So by the same token, I can take a dipole on 80 meters that should be 132 feet long. I shrink the dipole down to 32 feet long instead of 132 feet long. If I put that on an antenna analyzer, I'll find out it's got a capacitive reactance of 2,000 ohms, and it's got a resistance, a resistive component of 10 ohms. That's approximately what you're going to see, a 32-foot-long dipole on 80 meters. I put the right kind of an antenna tuning network on that dipole, bringing it into resonance and also impedance matching it. At the resonant frequency, it'll be a beautiful 50-ohm load, and it'll have a pattern exactly like the full half-wave dipole, and the gain will be within a half a dB. An infinitesimal dipole has got the exact same gain as a full-length dipole. Let me drop this. Never more than a half a dB down, as long as you've made out of low-loss materials. And the half a dB of loss in gain is not a loss in efficiency. It can still have an efficiency of 99.9% if I've used low-loss materials, and my antenna tuner has got big beefy coils and capacitors in it. I got a low-loss antenna tuner on low-loss materials on an infinitesimal dipole, and the half dB of loss in gain is not a loss in efficiency. The figure eight pattern becomes a little bit broader because the length is not there. You get a little bit less interferometry, giving you an antenna pattern. The figure eight is a little bit fatter in the middle, and that's therefore the peak of the pattern is a half dB weaker. But it's not a loss in gain, not a loss in efficiency. It's a loss of broadside gain, but never more than half a dB of loss, no matter how small you make the dipole. And by the same token, I can make my slot antenna shorter and shorter if I put a loading capacitor across the slot. I bet you didn't guess on that one, Steve. Here you go, Rich. KTUPS. And give us a tiny bit more audio, Steve. I mean, Rich. KTUPS in Ohio. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, hopefully this is a little bit better. Talk to the mic a little closer. It's very interesting antenna designs, I tell you, some of what they have on these different vehicles. And I'm always looking at different antennas on everything I pass, buildings or whatever. So, that's fascinating stuff. By the way, I left you a phone message the other day. I don't know if you got it or not. It's a simple yes or no. If not, I'll try to reach out to you again tomorrow. KTUPS.
Yeah, this is with reference to the Northeast Astronomy Forum, and yes, I am interested. I think I want to go and get a little bit more interested, get a little bit heavier back into astronomy, although I've got some big ham radio projects I got to finish too, so I think I'm interested in that, Steve. I think that's going to take place in May. Yes, turns out that any interruption between conductor and non-conductor can be made into an antenna. If there is a slight slot between the fender of your car and the body of your car, you can make that into an antenna. You can file a slot into the sheet metal anywhere on your automobile. Cover it over with fiberglass paint or whatever so that it's flush with the surface and you don't see a thing. And that can be a beautiful radiator. The side view mirror on your car could be mounted with a sheet of insulating material, and the side view mirror could be the quarter wave resonator that is the antenna. So any place where you interrupt conductor and non-conductor, you can make it into an antenna. So when it comes to a plain clothes vehicle, that is, it could have a zillion antennas in the vehicle, and you and I look at that vehicle with a good sharp set of eyes, and you will see nothing. You'll say to yourself, there ain't no antennas there. And a good smart antenna designer can make any interruption in that sheet metal into an antenna. I bet some of these things are a little bit of a surprise for you, aren't they, Steve? 82HUC, look what you got us into. Get your IW in the tech net.
Well, I'd say that you just turned about everything I ever learned on its head. I only have one more follow-up question, be clear. I don't want to monopolize the time, but this is something I definitely need to build on the bench so I can see it and play with it and so on and so forth. Usually you get 50 ohms when you feed a normal dipole from the center. And the further out you move the feed point, the higher the impedance goes. Is it the same thing with a slot antenna, or would it be the inverse? Does the impedance drop as you move away from center?
Yeah, that piece of wire that bridges the gap near one of the short circuit ends will give you a 50 ohm input impedance point. As you take that wire and bridging the gap and move it closer and closer to the end of the slot, the impedance goes down. You move that wire bridging the gap closer and closer to the center of the slot, and the impedance goes up. Across the very center of a slot antenna, I'm not sure the exact number, but you're probably going to measure something close to 1,000 ohms. As you slide it closer and closer to one end, it goes towards zero. There's a magic spot near one end. If my slot on a 900 megacycle antenna is 4.5 inches long, and I feed it 3/4 of an inch from one end, I'm going to find the 50 ohm point. If I fed it right in the center of the slot, I'm probably going to see 1,000 ohms of resistive component at resonance. In the case of a dipole made out of ordinary wire, the impedance in the center is around 70 ohms. By way of a gamma match or a delta match or I can't even think of the name of it. The parallel technique where there's another piece of wire alongside of the center of your dipole and it clips the end of that wire or touches the dipole right of center and left of center. I can't think of the name of the darn thing. You do that correctly and you get a beautiful impedance match. So, and by the way, the dipole doesn't have to be fed in the center. You could put the insulator in the center and feed it there and you're going to have a 70 ohm antenna. You slide the insulator off to one side and feed it, and the impedance goes up in the case of a dipole. As you go closer and closer to the outer tip of an ordinary dipole, the impedance goes up to 1,000, 1,500 ohms. And there's nothing stopping you from having a piece of wire as a dipole with no center insulator at all. And you feed it from one end, and you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance. As long as you've got an LC network there that steps up the impedance, a simple L, the right inductor and the right capacitor, which you can easily design out of the Stanford. Can't think of the name of the program. Say that again.
Match is what you want, Dick. So that you mentioned.
Okay, I'm hearing somebody on the input. Please repeat your message.
What match is the one you didn't know?
Please. Somebody's trying to give me a message, and they don't squeeze the mic long enough for the machine to pick up, therefore I'm not hearing the message. The person gave me the very brief message. Try again.
Bazooka match. Impedance match, take over.
I'm looking for the name of the college in California that has a
Berkeley.
Say again?
Right, the Berkeley. You said that there was. You told me about it once before. It's an impedance matching program from Berkeley.
That's it. Finally, somebody, Berkeley. I keep forgetting the name Berkeley. Somebody was trying to give me that information, and they weren't squeezing the mic long enough. If you Google the word Berkeley and impedance match, you'll get this beautiful program where if you know the resistive component and the reactive component of your load, antenna, whatever, and you know the frequency, you give that information to Berkeley, you press go, and you'll get 16 antennas of a LC network, a CL network, a pi network, an inverse pi network, and so on. A pi L network. You'll get a whole bunch of solutions with the exact values of the inductor and capacitor required to make it work, to give you impedance match and resonance, and choose the one that you like. So, impedance matching. If I'm feeding one end of a dipole, the open end of a piece of wire a half wavelength long that I've shot up into the tree with my bow and arrow, with my slingshot, and I'm feeding it one open end to ground because I've now made this vertical or a slant 45 degree dipole, and I'm feeding a 1500 ohm impedance, I add that L network, and now it'll work like a charm. So you can feed a dipole anywhere you want. All of the pictures we've seen in the book, let me drop it. The dipole is always a flat, smooth piece of wire, parallel to the ground, fit in the center. Yeah? That's the classic dipole, and everybody thinks it's got to be done that way. You can feed it anywhere along the length that you want to. It doesn't have to be vertical. It doesn't have to be a straight piece of wire. It can be zigzagged any way you want. It can be helical wound. It can have loading coils anywhere you want. Top hat capacitors anywhere you want. Stubs anywhere you want. As long as the structure you've created in that conductor that you call dipole, as long as that structure hits resonance at your favorite frequency, it'll radiate like a charm. Feed it anywhere you want to, as long as you're smart enough in impedance matching structures between your transmission line and that antenna, it'll radiate like a charm. Since the majority of what's going on in that dipole-like structure is a signal bouncing back and forth, we all want to believe that that signal coming off our transmission line hits the wire of our dipole, lights up that wire, and the signal jumps into space. That's what we want to believe. As you've heard me say so often, let me drop it. The signal that you launch on your dipole, I don't care if you're launching it at the output end or the center or anywhere in between, you launch a signal out of the dipole. For simplicity, let me talk about launching it in the center. That signal you launch under the dipole travels down the right-hand side and the left-hand side. If you've got the right kind of a balancing structure, you've got equal amount of voltage. You're launching a positive voltage on the right-hand side of the dipole, a negative voltage on the left-hand side of the dipole during this half cycle of the RF wave. That energy you've launched into the dipole travels down the dipole, 5% of it approximately gets radiated. The signal gets down to the open circuit end. 95% of it is left. It sees the open circuit end and reflects back. It goes back toward the center. Hits the center, which it thinks is a short circuit, and rebounces back again, back out. The signal bounces back and forth on your dipole 10 times before it's radiated. It has a Q of 10. It's got a 10% or so bandwidth. The signal is going to bounce back and forth and finally get radiated. That's what every dipole does. Almost all the antennas we know of, the signal does not get immediately radiated. It has to bounce back and forth. Every antenna has got a certain finite Q. Q really means the ratio between bandwidth and center frequency. It also means the current rise at resonance, the voltage rise at resonance, the rise time when you put a signal into it. So bandwidth, rise time, number of times a signal bounces, all of these things fall into the ratio or into the concept of Q. Radiation is hard. You've got to skip that signal in the tail 10 times in the row before it finally goes out into space. Now you know why. Let me drop it. Now you're starting to find out why resonance is so important. You want that. You know the signal, only 5% of it's going to be radiated by your antenna on the first pass. Therefore, the signal's going to be bouncing back and forth. You resonate the antenna. That makes sure that all the bounces are in step with each other. They're co-phase. Once all of those bounces are in step with each other, somewhere along that wire, the current is going to be 10 times higher. Somewhere along that wire, the voltage is going to be 10 times higher. The place where the current is 10 times higher means the local magnetic field is 10 times greater. That's what really gets radiated, in my opinion. Not everyone is going to agree with that one. But you look at any of the analyzing programs that analyze an antenna, it calculates how much current is flowing in each little segment of the wire, how much magnetic field is that made by that little segment, and most of the programs, like your NEC programs, numeric electronic code and so on, these programs that calculate antenna patterns, they calculate the current flowing through each little segment, and how much magnetic field that makes, and how much of that magnetic field you will sense at some particular point in space. And the program goes through various points in space, puts it all together, and says, hey, that is the antenna pattern. So you resonate the antenna so that the current will increase at resonance, so that the voltage will increase at resonance, so that the radiation takes place. That's why you resonate first. Anybody have further questions or comments on all of this? Give me your call letters right now, K2RW and the TechNet. very fine, Steve. You asked a good set of questions. You're probably going to have some more. So this thing that you thought was a non-radiator, a solid chunk of metal, and it looks like the majority, even if you take it apart, you'll find that the majority of the metal in that antenna is parallel to the ground plane, and it gets bolted down to a sheet of metal. Looks like it shouldn't radiate at all. And that slot antenna I told you guys about tonight, you put your ohm meter on that connector and you measure 0 ohms. You say that can't possibly be an antenna. You put your ohm meter across the connector that goes to an ordinary dipole, you'll measure an open circuit. So it becomes very obvious as to how you're launching voltage into that dipole. You've got an insulator in the center and a piece of wire to the right, a piece of wire to the left that's insulated from everything in space. In the case of a slot antenna, your ohm meter will show it's a dead short circuit except at the resonant frequency. By the same token, I can take a LC network. I can take an inductor and a capacitor across the inductor, choose the right value of inductor and capacitor so that it is resonant. And now I could decide to feed signal into that inductor by tapping it at one end for ground and a couple of turns up for the center conductor. I can easily launch a signal into that LC network, that resonator. Once again, my ohm meter on that connector will say that it's got 0 ohms. At the resonant frequency, it will be nearly an open circuit. A slot antenna falls into that category, except the slot does a beautiful job of radiating. Your LC network, if it was in a shielded IF can, it wouldn't radiate. Out into space, yes, it will radiate. And the word radiation is very relative. We, as ham radio operators, of all the energy we put into our antenna, we want 99% of it to be radiated. Let me drop the speaker. You talk to an electromagnetic compatibility expert, an EMI expert, electromagnetic interference expert. He's got a box on his testing bench in his anechoic chamber, and he's about to measure radiated extraneous fields. If the signal coming out of there is 60 dB down out of his box, that means 1 millionth of the power inside the box is leaking through the shield of the box and coming out. 60 dB down, 1 million to 1 power ratio. He calls that radiation because it wants to be perfectly shielded. So what he calls radiation and what you and I call radiation is the same thing but drastically different in magnitude. We want 99.9% radiation. He wants less than 1 million to 1 ratio. But if he gets only 1 million to 1, he calls it radiation. His spec might be 70 dB down, and he only measures 60, and he says that box is radiating. Okay, we're going to go over to Joe now. W2LYY. You got it, Joe. K2LIW in the tech net.
I'm leaving plenty of time so everything will reset. Okay? Here's the question. I'd like to know specifically which site on the FCC system of sites that they have that gives you details on how the channels are going to be laid out with this up-and-coming TV channel auction. I believe somebody said past Channel 38, but I want to read it myself. I'd like to find out when it's going to take place and exactly what website this information can be found on when somebody's looking for it. Back to you.
Yeah, the right person to talk to on this is going to be Eric, KE2EJ. And you said when it's going to take place. It has already taken place. Past tense. It's over. Game over. Right now, we're using UHF channels up to channel, I think it's 51. The channels between channel 35 and 51 have been sold, is my understanding. So, in the next 39 months, according to Eric, the FCC hasn't set an exact date in which this would be trade over, but we're going to stop using HVSB as a method of transmitting digital television over the air. We're going to go over to COFDM, which is the more European structure. So, our current television over the air hardware is about to become obsolete. We're going to have to buy converter boxes or new television sets if you're watching over-the-air television. Let me drop. And starting above channel 35, which is roughly 600 megacycles, 600 megacycles and up, has been sold. Sometime in the near future, the television broadcast channels that are on those frequencies now will move. they're being given financial incentive by the FCC. These television broadcast stations are being handed a chunk of money to allow them to pay for the hardware and the construction and whatever to move themselves away from those frequencies above 600 megs, and they're going to be reassigned to frequencies below 600 megs. And most of those assignments have already been revealed to those broadcast stations. What is now Channel 13 is going to become Channel 12, RF-wise. It's still going to be identified as Channel 13. What's called Channel 21, I think it's also going to move, but there I'm not sure. So,
32.
There we go. So, Eric, give us a little bit more of the information that you gave us a week or two ago. Don't worry about repeating yourself, because we can tell that Joe feels that we're about to go to an auction. I think the auction has already taken place. KE2EJ, tell us anything you want to on this subject. KE2LIW in the tech net. You got it, Eric.
KE2LIW, KE2EJ. The auction is not quite over. The part about who's buying what, a chunk of what's available, is still happening. I think it actually occurs in next week sometime. But basically, for all practical purposes, the auction is over. And how much detail do you want? I can give you more or less detail.
Tell us everything, Eric, because the majority of us who are not in the broadcast industry like you are have not read anything in our newspapers about it yet. Our trade magazines have not given us very much information yet, little bitty hints. So go into as much detail as you want to. And by the way, Erica, either I had a slight failure or Channel 21 was off the air a short period of time this morning. KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
You don't miss this thing. KE2LIW, KE2EJ. Actually, yeah, we were off for as long as it took them to call me and get into the car and run up here and take care of the problem. I'm just looking for my little page here that has all the current information on it. Hey, here we go. By the way, moving to ATSC3 is a broadcast that can do it when they want. There's no cutoff date for ATSC1 to stop transmitting to it. It's not going to be quite the same thing. There we go. Let me go to drop. Okay. So, I don't know whether you guys were aware, this started out as a reverse auction, whereas, if Channel 2 were to go completely off the air, they would have been paid $960 million. If they chose to move to a lower channel, a VHF channel, because they were currently on a UHF channel, they would get $400,000 or $500,000 at the first round of the auction. The auction went four rounds, so here it is. The fourth and final forward TV spectrum incentive auction is now closed at $19,632,506,746. Okay, so this was on February 10th. The forward auction itself is not, but the auction itself is not over. The forward auction winners will next vie for specific frequencies. Let me go to drop again. Okay, the participation of these broadcasters and wireless carriers will enable Caribbean, that is the FCC, to release 84 megahertz of spectrum into the broadband marketplace. These low-band airwaves will improve wireless coverage, this is a commercial, across the country and will play a particularly important role in deploying mobile broadband services in rural areas, says FCC Chairman Pai in a statement. Okay, here's an interesting little bit. The bidding went into lightning rounds of 40 minutes each on Wednesday morning, February 8th. Money to drop again. Okay, fewer than 20 of the 832 licensed areas remained active in the lightning rounds. Most of these were small markets but unreserved spectrum in New Orleans crept back into play at one point. All right, well, you get the idea. So, the concept is now, is that now all of this has been sold, they have to do what they're calling repack, which means we, at least in